I used to turn to my partners and say, they give us a shield, they give us a gun, and they give us a car. They'd say, go out and lock up bad guys. And then they pay us for it. They paid us. I had the best job in the world. I loved it.
It's FAQ NYC Off-Cycle, where the New Yorkers podcast steps back to take different and deeper looks into some of the things that are always happening here in the only place in the world. I'm Harry Siegel, the pod's executive producer, here with journalist Steve Fishman to talk about his epic new 10-part podcast, episodes are coming out right now, about Louis Garcella, the cigar-smoking, tattooed NYPD detective once nicknamed the closer for his uncanny ability to crack crimes, extract confessions, and lock up some of the city's baddest guys back in its bad old days. But as the podcast gets into, and it gets into a lot, there's some incredible conversations with Garcella himself, who's quite the New York character, and with some of the men imprisoned for years and decades thanks to his police work, several of these convicted murderers turned jailhouse lawyers who'd maintained their innocence eventually found each other, and they realized that what linked them was this one detective and his partner, and, in several cases, a prostitute who testified to being an eyewitness to a remarkable number of murders. So judges have now vacated many of those convictions, and the city and state have paid out $110 million so far in civil suits. Even as the man, now regularly referred to as a disgraced former detective, is still drawing his pension and maintaining he was a good cop. Some headlines have called him a rogue detective, but you might also say he represented a police department and a city eager to lock presumed bad guys up and not so concerned with how that process worked. So, quick full disclosure, couple, I've talked with Garcella over the years, but never convinced him to go on the record as he does in The Burden. And I've only started listening to The Burden as I've been meaning to for the last couple of weeks, but I've been dealing with my own NYPD mess with chiefs and then commissioners there attacking me and sometimes slandering me with the blessing of the mayor. So he was an ex-cop himself, of course. All that said, welcome, Steve, and let's jump right in. Maybe you want to start by just telling listeners about how New Yorkers learned about Scarcella's alleged wrongdoings in the first place, what drew you to want to do a podcast about him and get further in, and how you then went about reporting this story, including connecting with him and getting him to talk not just with you, but even with one of the since exonerated people he helped convict.
Yeah. Thanks, Harry. Thanks for having me. That was a great introduction. And I don't know, congratulations or condolences on your sudden attention from the NYPD. You know, it's a kind of honor in a way. So listen, we started this podcast way too many years ago, like 4 years ago. And the premise was a lot of people were hearing about this cop, Scarcella, but nobody was hearing from Scarcella. And I guess I'd spent a lot of time at New York Magazine as a staff writer, and I had kind of made it my business to get to people who wanted to stay out of the limelight. So, you know, I stalked Bernie Madoff for about a year until he called me from prison to just get me off his back. and I wanted to talk to detective, former detective, retired detective Scarcella. You know, there was a ton written about him. The New York Times did a series of groundbreaking articles. And Harry, I know you've written about him. A lot of people have written about him. But it was kind of triangulating this guy. And Harry, you had off the record conversation, so I'm sure you had more insight into him. But still, this guy was like a black hole that you couldn't really understand why he had done what he was alleged to have done, what he had done. And in a sense, you know, how does something like this happen, right? Because something happened. Whatever happened, and Scarcella obviously says he did nothing wrong. And then there are a lot of people with checkbooks on the other side who will you tell you differently. I decided that I was going to track this guy down. I started calling people as reporters do and calling people to call people and coming back empty-handed. And then one day my phone rings. I'm in my bedroom. My phone rings and it's Louis Scarcella. And he says, all right, I want to talk. Actually, he's got a great, great Brooklyn accent that I can't do, but imagine it, if you will. He I want to talk, but I don't want to talk on the phone. And so he invites me.
It's thick. It's like a Guys and Dolls thick.
It is, yeah. And it's evocative. You know, evocative. And it's you know, Scarcelle is a bright guy. But, you know, he talks that kind of cop talk. So it's dramatic, and it makes the emphasis where he wants to. It doesn't always comport with exact rules of grammar. I hope that was obscure enough or abstract enough to make a point. Scarcella says we meet at the Coney Island Diner. Coney Island's a big deal for Scarcella. Believe it or not, Harry, you haven't gotten to this yet, but this guy was a first grade detective and at the same time, a near full-time carnival barker at Coney Island. Come on in, come on over, the Derby horse races. He's a guy who's working like the night shift till 4 a.m., goes home, takes a shower, runs a marathon, and then goes into work to catch the bad guys. And I will tell you that in a bonus episode to subscribers only, you will find out how one cheats at one of these games. And it's interesting.
You just got a subscriber right there.
Good. You're number one. But for the burden, what I really wanted to do was kind of get him. So this begins once we meet at the diner, and Louis talks and talks and talks. And, you know, he tells these unbelievable stories, you know, like they're chilling, but they're also, you cannot not listen to them, you know. And I actually started the podcast with one, and I'll just digress a minute to tell you, to give you a flavor. It's lunchtime at a court hearing where Scarcella is supposed to testify. So they've got like 2 hours off. Scarcella and his partner decide it's a great time to hunt down a murder suspect. Now, I do love the detail that these guys are dressed in coats and ties, right? So they go to Park Slope, and this is back in the 80s, so it's a different Park Slope than most of you will know. And they, Scarcella sees a little Italian guy with a cheroot and says, "Where's this guy?" Shows him a photo. The guy says, "He lives over there." This guy walks out of the building at that point, and this is Scarcella's version of the story. This guy has a big Sig Sauer in his waistband, so a big assault weapon in his waistband. Scarcella races the car over. He jumps on him. He pulls out his gun, puts his Glock to the suspect's head, and pulls the trigger. The Glock does not fire. It goes out of battery. And so now they're fighting hand to hand. And the story goes that Scarcella and his partner knock the guy to the ground and handcuff. I heard this story a lot because Scarcella never tells a story just once. And each time I had this same question in my mind, which I finally got to ask him, I said, "Do you ever imagine that clock goes off?" And he says, "Are you kidding? I wanted it to. He was going for a Sig Sauer, a big Sig Sauer. What am I supposed to do? Kiss him?" So now you have a taste of Louis Scarcella and the good old days for a cop like Scarcella, which were the bad old days for New York City. I just want to mention Scarcella at that moment had a superhero nickname. His fellow cops called him the Hulk, because he was willing to do justice hand to hand if necessary. Back to the Coney Island Diner. Scarcella talks. He tells stories like this. "I think we're getting along royally. I ask him, hey, when are we going to get into the studio? And he says, no. Let's meet and let's talk again. And so begins a kind of series of tests, as I saw it. You know, he says, all right, meet me at the Russian baths, right? So, like, you know, there's like all these half-naked men and some women kind of going from pool to sauna to ice chest. And I go into the sauna with him, and he's lecturing me on how good this is for your health. And he starts beating me with oak leaves, which he's explaining is also good for your health. next test is I have to jump into the freezing Atlantic outside because Scarsella is former president of the Polar Bear Club. And again, this is like a third kidney, you know, it takes the toxins out. Listen, there are a couple other tests. We actually go down that prostitute that you mentioned. We go to search for her and we find her house and where her mother lived. Her mother had just passed, sadly. But Scarsella, I finally say to him, did I pass the test? And he says, pass the test. And he comes into the studio. So we ended up talking to him for maybe 35 hours. And I will say, you know, Harry, I know you know this from the reporting you do, but like when you talk to somebody and get them to open up and you start hearing their story, yeah, you want to pin them down. Yeah, you want to kind of ask them the hardest questions. But just hearing them talk about who they are and what they do and how they do it, it's revelatory. So one example here, Scarsella, his era, they did not have a lot of DNA. They did not have a lot of closed circuit TV. So Scarsella explains to me that what he really went on was his ability to read people, which he tells me was infallible. On the job, he was never wrong. Okay. Now later I'd say to him, Louis, you know, that sounds crazy. You know, that sounds like magic. And he said, yes. He said, but detectives have the biggest egos. And I guess I was one of them. He also says that the way that he would get a confession was through what he called ruses. And so he tells these stories about finding a guy who had, his girlfriend had just died. The guy had their baby in his hands and Louis Scarsella gets down and prays with him and starts to cry. And this provokes the guy to confess. He talks, I'll tell one more story about Louis in this. And he talks about being on an airplane, transporting a prisoner back from upstate New York. And Scarsella has arranged with the then stewardess to come and whisper something in his ear because there's been kind of roughness and air pockets on the plane. And according to Scarsella, he turns to the suspect who is in the seat next to him. And he says, I got to take your handcuffs off because we may go down and you may have to swim. And again, according to Scarsella, this provokes a kind of come to Jesus moment. And the guy confesses and Scarsella takes it on takes the confession on a cocktail napkin. And then pure Scarsella, coda to the story, he says, me and my partner go into the bar at the airport with the bad guy, and we all have shots, including the guy they're arresting for murder. Anyhow, Harry, I've been rambling quite a bit.
We're going to get more rambling, and I don't want to take us too far from Scarsella, but as you're talking about letting somebody just go through their whole story and how revelatory that is, and this is something, of course, that police, when they're questioning someone, also want to do because they're pinning down facts and specific things to go through and getting the information perimeter, if you will, right? And ruses and how things are expressed when you're conveying someone else's story, right? Like a detective might in paperwork and on the witness stand. How much of this was tugging at you as a journalist and making you think about the those same things from our profession?
Well, that's a great question, and I really don't say that a lot because I constantly thought of that. I thought, first of all, his instincts were infallible. Well, what was he thinking about me? You know, did he think I was, you know, his confidant, his advocate? You know, and then I also thought Louis had an expression, which I'm pretty sure is a widely used cop expression, is, and then he gave it all up, meaning the guy confessed. And so my thought was, well, how am I going to get Louis to give it all up? You know, and what am I going to tell him? And there was always this kind of dance because, you know, you spend a lot of time with somebody. And I feel that one of the important things that I can do in journalism, and maybe everybody doesn't agree, but to try and see the world through someone else's eyes. So I did actually make that effort with Scarsella. And, you know, it's a very seductive relationship, the very close relationship between a subject and a reporter. You know, you're kind of in an interesting bear hug. Listen, there was no one who was more interested in Scarsella's past cases, no one who knew more about Scarsella's past cases than I did. And I probably knew more than Louis Scarsella knew about them, frankly. But if he wanted to talk to somebody about his life, he wanted to talk to me.
So an expression I miss from old-timey movies and radio and whatnot is, you'd hear it all the time, speaking of giving it up, is what's it all about? And it was like human dialogue, and it was also expository dialogue, because then you, the other person could say what it's all about. You have, in addition to your journalistic endeavors, a bar, you were telling me. And I'm fascinated by this in part because Derek Hamilton and one of the other fellows who received a payment, hold on one second, I'm just blanking on Shabaka Shakur. They opened a bar in part with some of the settlement money they had. And I know you got to hear their stories and perspectives. And maybe if there's anyone else who knows as much about Scarsella, it might be Derek Hamilton, Joel Rudin and the attorney, Jabbar Collins, this group of guys, regular attorneys, jailhouse attorneys, who had to figure all this out from the inside in a mystery that they were deeply and generally involuntarily involved in. So maybe we could talk, or you could talk a little about that.
Oh, yeah.
And the people on the other side of this ledger.
Yeah. And you know, in a way, listen, you have a cop story and you have all these cases and you have lots of drama because there's, you know, in crime, there's always drama. But the real heart of the story, the real soul of the story, you have to imagine and try and put yourself in the place of people who are arrested, convicted, and sentenced for murder, who claim they are innocent, who believe, who maybe are innocent, but who certainly claim they are innocent.
Which means they're not getting any breaks if they can't prove this one way or another. Like you're not getting off early for good behavior if you won't account for your crime. It makes things very difficult a whole number of ways. And it means you can't take any sort of plea, no matter how generous in some cases.
And you know, like the first step is quite courageous too, because I think as many people know, if you take a plea, you're arrested, you're charged. Usually there's a plea negotiation. And the state is pretty happy not to have to spend resources to go through a trial. So they'll give you a deal. But if you turn that down and you go to trial, you are risking, and I think almost always get a much harsher sentence. So
you can't afford more trials. This is the warning system. If you want to fight this and you lose, you're going to get hit and hit hard. And of course, if you take the plea, you have to allocute and read, however unhappily, I did this and I did that. And that's what you're getting sentenced for. So there's a sort of person who has a question of integrity. It's like, I did not do a thing. I will not say those words.
Absolutely. So these guys, Shabaka Shakur in particular, and Derek Hamilton, both go to trial. Scarsella testifies in both those cases. And it's the early 90s. Shabaka Shakur is the late 80s. The city has 2,000 murders a year. Crack is all over. People are afraid of violence. Juries believe detectives. They believe prosecutors. You know, send them all to prison and let God sort it out. And I will say also, listen, you know, Derek Hamilton, Shabaka Shakur, they had both had previous arrests. They had felonies on their records. So, you know, another cop expression I like is, you know, one cop turns it to the other and says, you know, I like Shabaka Shakur for this crime. You know, I like him for the murder. And they liked him. we can get into that discussion too, because philosophically, I think it's interesting, you know, rehabilitation, mm-hmm. are people redeemable? You know, a lot of these people who are arrested, Derek Hamilton, for instance, goes to prison at age 18 for a previous crime. He spends almost all of his adult life in prison. But these guys meet up at Auburn Correctional Facility, right? And Chepaca has turned himself into a jailhouse lawyer, actually at the urging of Derek Hamilton, because they meet when Chepaca first goes to prison. And Derek says to him, "You're innocent, you better get to the law library and work, because lawyers do not care if you get out. You are the only one who cares about your case." Chepaca really ignores that advice for about 10, 15 years. Meanwhile, Derek is becoming a really elite jailhouse lawyer. As he told me, the law was my girlfriend. I had to love the law. It was my only way to freedom. So, you know, there's like a kind of wild romance about this, and I'm jumping all around. But one of the things about this story, it's not just grim crime, bad guys, good guys. It's a story of triumph by these guys who are the most oppressed people in America. I mean, an inmate is running his defense over a prison payphone. You know, he's licking his own stamps. He's writing letters. Derek Hamilton used to call the judge's chambers because he couldn't get a decision out of them. So he would say he was from the Daily News and he wants to hear about the Derek Hamilton case, trying to put pressure on him, right? Any way he could. Well, one day, these guys end up in Auburn Correctional. Chepaca is already there. Derek comes in, and word goes through the yard that Derek Hamilton, who's already known throughout the New York prison system as an extremely accomplished jailhouse lawyer, has arrived. And the word gets to Chepaca, gets to a guy named Nelson Cruz, and Nelson already knows about Derek. And he says to me, Derek is like a god when it comes to criminal law. So now these guys all want to get together in the law library, and they really constitute themselves as a law firm. They push their desks together. They're studying law books. Derek is lecturing, because he's the master of procedure, on a whiteboard. They're all going over their case and analyzing it. Chepaca is a very good writer, very insightful about the law. There are other people who are like the public relations people, and this guy Nelson's the youngest. We called him like the intern. He actually makes the coffee, which, this being prison, he makes through a sock. He strains the coffee through a sock in his cell. One day, Derek is looking at Chewbacca's motion. He's never known who the cop was in Chewbacca's case, and he discovers that the cop in Chewbacca's case is Scarsella. And he says, "That's the same motherfucker who put me away. The same motherfucker who framed me. We got to get at this guy." And Nelson also discovers he has Scarsella in his case. So you got three at the heart, at the center of this jailhouse law firm, who suddenly have this like electric moment where they discover the same cop is in their case. And as one defense lawyer told me, that moment changes New York legal history. And these guys get together and they say, "We gotta get this cop. We gotta target this cop." And they do.
Taking a step back for a minute, I'm sort of thinking we're going to weave between the narrative and some of these step backs. The way Ken Thompson becomes the Brooklyn District Attorney, he opens a wrongful conviction unit that starts looking at older cases, and in my view, with a real thumb on the scale, the older cases, so that are less likely to implicate prosecutors and people who are still there. And this becomes a really complicated dance with all sorts of defense attorneys, ones inside jails and other ones who have clients who maintain their innocence. But can you put some of this into the frame of this moment where crime has been lower enough for long enough that some things that it seemed real permanent, like you just got to put some dudes away. And, you know, marijuana is a pretext for stopping young Black and Hispanic guys, which Thompson also stops. He says, "We're not taking those cases anymore." That sort of weeds to the moment we're at now. How this reexamination, the press attention it receives at the time, and this set of guys, you know, several of whom are out and doing interesting sorts of legal and legal related work now, relates to that broader picture. And I'm thinking about this in part because there's a lot of things are worse than they were before the pandemic. We need to be doing more. The cops are doing their job. The rest of the justice system is the problem stuff happening now. That this is not 2,000 murders a year. These are not the bad old days, but has me thinking about that and how those pendulums swing.
Absolutely. You know, I think, you know, you have to say that just before this mayoral election, which Eric Adams won as a an ex-cop, there was an uptick in violence, and Eric Adams really ran that message, that same message that we heard back in the 80s and 90s. And listen, Harry, you're right. The 2,000 murders a year is nothing like what we have now, which is, I think, closer to 400.
Just over 400, and stranger murders at this point are an even lower share.
Oh, interesting.
So the odds of, you know, if you're just thinking about the scary thing that could happen, you know, it does happen, but it's not very common. You know, you are extremely unlucky at this point.
Wow, that's interesting. I hadn't done that dissection of the statistics. That's very interesting.
I have that anecdotally from police stats people, and the way they track that, and that's not like one of the numbers that's in CompStat, but that they have awareness of it, you know, and who's a true victim and who's not, so to speak.
That's really interesting. So back, you know, back then, I mean, you had two points of view. You had Scarsella like walking out of his the station one night and saying, hearing shots and saying, I'm hearing the shots of my next murder. And Scarsella, and listen, most cops at that point, I think they loved the action. You know, they loved it because they felt they were needed. They were charged by the mayor to go in and clean up the city, take back the city. That was actually a program, take back the city under Dinkins. And so, you know, they felt kind of vaguely great. And then, you know, you had ordinary citizens who were fleeing the city, who were, you know, one guy told me, I couldn't stop at a traffic light because I was afraid I'd be carjacked. And then, you know, fast forward now into the era when Thompson's running. And what's kind of fascinating is actually one district attorney kind of spans that era. So Joe Hines is the district attorney for 24 years. So he actually puts Derek Hamilton in prison. His office does. And then Derek Hamilton, you know, 20 some years later is petitioning his office to get him out. It's really a fascinating. And Thompson now, Ken Thompson, and, you know, Hines is an old white guy. He's 78 years old. He's running for, I think, a seventh term. And crime is going away in big part, certainly violent crime. And here comes Thompson, who, by the way, has a connection to the housing projects. He's raised there. His mom's a cop. He's was an assistant U.S. attorney. He's a black man. He's got a great biography for the moment. And he makes wrongful convictions an issue in the election. In fact, he by name makes Scarsella an issue. And
yes,
his issue, the way he phrases it, which is very clever politically and I think accurate sociologically, is, you know, Hines has come out and he has actually overturned, he had his own conviction review unit, he's overturned the conviction of David Ranta, which was a famous Scarsella case. And he has basically pointed at Scarsella and named him, don't worry, he's the bad apple. We got the bad apple. It's not systemic. Nothing to see here. Move on, right?
And just need to note there that as he does this, and actually as Thompson continues with this, and then please keep rolling, right? They're both directly saying, this is the guy, this is the problem. These are the cases we need to look at. But they're finding technical reasons, legal technical reasons for each specific case that are not, this guy did that bad thing. And that's continued out of fear that this cop was so active, this detective was so active, and with this partner the whole time, same dude, Stefan, I don't know how you pronounce it, maybe Camille.
Yeah, Camille.
My view throughout has been they're worried that if they identify him as the issue, all of these bad guys who did do the bad thing that they've been convicted of would be out, and that would be the Pandora's box. And maybe the one that would lead you from the way cops and prosecutors talk about a bad apple to the actual expression about the bad apple spoiling the barrel.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, what's really interesting there is, you know, bad guys have been let out of prison. And in fact, guilty guys. I mean, one guy, De Leon, had his conviction overturned. Scarcella figured in it, kind of peripherally, but nonetheless figured in it. And as a result of that, and Scarcella's reputation as now a corrupt cop, his conviction, De Leon's conviction, was overturned. He goes to retrial for the same judge who has overturned the conviction, and she finds him guilty based on the evidence. So you have, you know, a really interesting situation where you can say factually that a guilty guy had his conviction overturned. And now there are clearly other guys who are like terrific gangsters. Sam Edmondson, known as Baby Sam, the founder of Crack Inc., who was, seems to have been universally considered as a very dangerous guy. He had his conviction overturned by Scarcella, you know, and that because of Scarcella. And, you know, that does come down to an interesting question because, you know, cops are all often tagged with this phrase, you know, this thought. Well, if he didn't do this, he did another one, right? And the retort to that from the defense community and legal aid people especially is, yeah, but the system can't cheat. You know, you can't go convicting a guy on one crime that he didn't do because he did other crimes. And, you know, we saw that in The Burden several times. I give you the example of Derek Hamilton, and it's a good example because it spans the Hines-Thompson era. So what happens is, to get kind of back into that, Scarcella, his David Ranta case, the first one, the Hines one, is overturned right in the middle of an election for district attorney. Very political. Hines is trying to discard the issue, put it behind him. The contender, Ken Thompson, won't let him do that. Thompson prevails, and he becomes committed to wrongful convictions. Now, I really do think that was a sincere conviction. It's also a promise he made, and he had political debts to pay because Derek Hamilton, who's out on parole, is going door to door in the project saying, vote for Ken Thompson. So I think there was a certain amount of political capital that was expended there. But Thompson comes in, and as you said, he starts to great fanfare. He hires a Harvard lawyer to oversee it. He says, I'm giving it $1 million. And it is true, by the way, that Hines had formed it had a different name, but it was the same unit. But then he like buried it in paperwork, and it had one investigator and one attorney. So it was never really set up to be the real deal. And Thompson comes in and makes it the real deal. But now Derek Hamilton's case comes up. He is pushing for an exoneration to overturn his conviction. It comes to Thompson. Thompson's conviction review unit is still made up of people from the old era. And they hate Derek Hamilton. They hate him. First of all, they think he was guilty. Second of all, they think he was guilty of a previous murder, which happened to be the father of a cop. And they are sick of his appeals because he is appealing all the time, and he's writing appeals for other inmates. So they have no love for him. So the first recommendation that comes out of the conviction review unit is to keep Derek Hamilton in prison and oppose this motion. And it was described to me by the current district attorney, Gonzalez, who was the number two at the time, said this was a turning point for the new district attorney, Ken Thompson. And Ken Thompson says to that old guard, this is the way we're going to do business now. We're going to look at the facts. We're not going to say what happened in the past, who we think this guy is. We're going to look at the past. And if you can't get with that, then you need to leave. So Thompson gives the file to his number two, Eric Gonzalez. Eric Gonzalez says, there's no way he should have been convicted. And Derek, his conviction is overturned. Now, we went back to that case and we spent a lot of time with it. There's one eyewitness, and we tracked her down in the rural part of North Carolina, knocked on her door for the first half hour of that interview, which happened, by the way, like with the door closed. She's talking to us through a closed window. She denies that she is the witness, that she is that person. And then finally, she slips up and she uses the first person. She says, I did. And so now it's at, finally, we know we're talking to the witness, right? Finally, we know we're talking to the witness. But we went really deep into this case. And one of the things that we actually got visibility on was a confidential report that the district attorney did. So the CRU does a report. The conviction review unit does a report. Well, there was one that was kind of floating around, but it had a lot of redactions, including this most important section called findings and recommendations. So we were able to get some visibility on what that blacked out part was. And it was kind of fascinating because Scarcella, yes, was at the middle of this case, right? Absolutely at the center of it. But, you know, like, justice in New York, it was not the Louis Scarcella show. He's a guy with a ninth grade education, right? He's a guy who believed that he had a crystal ball in his gut. You know, it's like, this is not the guy running criminal justice. It really is the district attorney's office. And this report goes after one of its own. Now, being kind to itself, it had blocked that out. But the assistant district attorney who prosecutes Hamilton is called out by name, Ann Gutman, and it basically says she did not do justice. She, and this is my word, she cheated, and she cheated more than once. And she basically, and I mean, we have the transcript, we can tell you what happened. She lied to the jury. And so it's fascinating that, yes, Scarcella was this guy who, you know, he pushed the boundaries. He pushed past the boundaries. I think you have to conclude that there were cases in which detectives went in, couldn't get a confession. Scarcella went in 20 minutes alone, walks out with an incriminating statement. Listen to me, that just seemed really suspicious. And it seemed that way to a judge as well. But Scarcella was largely, for years and years, exonerated by the district attorney's office, because the district attorney's office said, well, you know, we were in charge. Honestly, they never said it publicly, but they were saying it privately.
So there's an awful lot in the burden. We're not going to be able to get to all of it. And we shouldn't, because if you're enjoying this conversation, you'll really enjoy the podcast. But I do want to touch on three things we haven't gotten to. Maybe some of them weave together. Maybe you hit each one separately. We do need to discuss his uncle and maybe his uncle's murder. I'd love to know about trying to track down and talk with Teresa Gomez. And you've told me, and I've not got to hear yet, which I'm very eager to do, that there is a direct conversation between Scarcella and one of the people who his police work helped locked up. And of course, when you go through the justice system, everyone speaks in turns, and those turns are staggered. So being able to have one person who knows their own case intimately talking with the detective who helped make that case, I like this guy. Been finding the narrative, and detectives, for better and worse, have to back into that often. I just love to hear about those three things in the remaining time we have. And thank you for coming on. I'm greatly enjoying the conversation. I hope listeners are.
Yeah, I hope so too. You know, the seductive part for you and me is that we both know this case and we're so fascinated by it. And I worry that people get lost in the details, but I will tell you, because these are actually two stories that really kind of stand alone. The first is the Louis Scarcella's uncle, known as Nicky Black, Nicky Grancio. Scarsella comes from Bensonhurst. Oh, it used to be a real Italian enclave. And what was said about that place is that a lot of people went into civil service, so they became sanitation workers, cops, and firefighters. Scarsella's dad is a cop, his brother's a cop, and Louis becomes a cop as well. His uncle, his mother's brother, becomes a mobster. And that's where the other faction or another faction of the Bensonhurst Italian enclave goes. His uncle, Nicky Black, is, I think he became a captain in the Colombo crime family. And Louis's relationship with him is complex. He admires his dad. He respects his dad. He adores his uncle, Nicky. He adores his uncle, Nicky. So he tells us a story about being with Nicky when he's 12 years old. Louis's 12 years old. And bullets are coming through the windshield. A guy is trying to assassinate his uncle. Scarsella's in the front seat next to him. And bullets are flying through the windshield. I said, so how did that make you feel? And he said, oh, it was surreal. It was surreal. I was like, I didn't know what to think. And I said, but I'll tell you this, Louis was a great driver. I mean, Nicky was a great driver. He turned out of there really quick. I mean, all his stories end with great admiration for his uncle, Nicky. Now, here's the amazing twist, is that Nicky Black is the main suspect in the murder of a sometime drug dealer in Bensonhurst, who is assigned to investigate Uncle Nicky. His nephew, Detective Scarsella. Detective Scarsella is investigating his own uncle. And by the way, his superior knows, superiors know about this. But it is a crazy situation in which he has to interview and ask for, try to get the confession of his uncle about a murder that the street believes his uncle committed. And what happens is, this is the confession Scarsella can't get. This is the case he can't crack. He goes to his uncle and says words like, so what happened? And his uncle will say only, the kid deserved to die. The kid deserved to die. And why is that? Because the story from the street, which Scarsella told me, is that Nicky Black's daughter was hooked on drugs by the guy who's killed. He deserved to die. So there is an internal police investigation of this eventually. And as you might imagine, it's a little unusual. And Scarsella, it's not much of an investigation. Scarsella is basically the main witness. He talks for 10 minutes and says, in effect, you know, if he did it, if I could have proved it, I would have arrested him. But I couldn't prove it. So I said to him, but he did murder the kid, right? And Scarsella said, well, I couldn't prove it, but yeah, the FBI said it. I said, so Nicky Black is a murderer. He said, I hate to use that word about my uncle, because Scarsella said to me, he was the most honorable man I know, the most honorable man I know. So this is the mobster. And then I pressed Scarsella, but he was a murderer. And he says, okay, he was a murderer. You happy now that I said it? And I said, why was it so hard to say? He said, I don't know, it just is. But so here you have the contradiction of a guy being the most honorable man he could know and a murderer. And you know, we see this because Scarsella then ends up being a detective in exclusively Black neighborhoods. And one wonders if Scarsella can make those same kinds of distinction between a guy who is essentially a good person, but may have committed some crimes, right? Even violent crimes. And that's not what we see in the roster of people who have gone away. But we do see it when he's on his home turf with somebody he knows, somebody whose culture is familiar to him and his values are familiar to him. Now, the other thing that happens in this case is that And this is a little off the case, but I did actually interview the person who murdered Nikki Black. Because Nikki Black, the Colombo Wars happened, where the family divides. It's a civil war. And I think it's 92, the early 90s. This company is just hunting. They're one another's hunting for each other. And Nikki Black becomes a target. And I interviewed the guy, Larry Mazza, who shot him, pulled up behind him and shot him in the head. And Scarcella is notified and runs to the scene. And apparently a cop there says, well, you know, this is the life he chose, right? It was something derogatory, something which Scarcella took as insensitive, disrespectful. And Scarcella at that point had to be held back, you know, he was in tears and emotional. I do also kind of want to, conclude that story because, you know, this goes to kind of who Scarcella is. He had a sense of justice. I mean, it's not like he's targeting random people. He like goes in, he thinks he knows what happened. He believes that this is wrong or this is right or this guy is bad or this guy is not bad. And he acts on that. And so he posed to me, we were sitting in a diner a few days after we had the Nikki Black conversation. And he said, well, how about if you're kid was hooked on drugs by a guy you knew. What would you do to the guy? And, you know, it's the kind of question that's you don't want to quite answer because, you know, you and I deal with crime as comp stat statistics. We deal with it as interviewing people who we're not connected to. But, you know, crime is always also something that people deal with by imagining themselves as victims. So if I had been personally implicated, I answered that. I said, I would have wanted to kill the guy, but it's not in my blood. And Louis sitting at the diner with me said, I think I would have killed him and just turned myself in. He said, we had something we called public service murders. He said, and this fit the criteria. And that's a really chilling phrase. I'm just going to let that hang there for a minute.
That might be where we should close, leaving a couple of the things I asked unanswered, because you can listen and hear all of this. Again, the podcast is The Burden. You can find it all the places podcasts are found. The episodes are still coming out, so this is an excellent time to get up to speed. I think there's 6 out now and 4 more coming. Is that right?
That's right, 10. And we got a couple bonuses, and I'm just going to tempt you, Harry, to subscribe because Teresa Gomez was the crack addict prostitute that Scarcella used in what was first said to be 6 different cases, a witness who saw 6 different murders. In fact, Scarcella told us she saw 11 murders. Right. Whatever the number is, it seemed astounding. And she was a crack addict. And you read her testimony. We got a hold of some of her testimony. It's just, it's kooky. It's all over the place. In 2 different trials, she can't remember what year she was. The same year she was married. She has 2 different years. So she died in like 1992. So I researched this a long time, right? And there's one photo of her available. And no one has ever heard her voice. No one since she died in 92. So we, of course, have been sending foils out. A year after we sent a foil out about one of the cases she was to testify in our email box comes the file, the complete file of the defendant. And in it is Teresa Gomez giving a statement, an audio statement to an assistant district attorney about this case. So if you listen to this podcast and you want to hear and judge for yourself the credibility of this magical, talented witness who seemed to have seen murders just about everywhere, come and subscribe. And in any case, please listen. Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, The Burden. Thanks, Harry. This was great.
FAQ.
Thank you.
FAQ NYC is the flagship show of the forthcoming FAQ NYC podcast network. We receive support from PNT Knitwear, an independent bookstore, cafe, and event space on Manhattan's Lower East Side with the podcast studio that can be freely reserved for community use. The pod's friends include The City, a nonprofit newsroom where journalists including R. Katie Honan and me deliver hard-hitting news that serves the people of New York. The Colin Powell School at CUNY City College, where our host, Dr. Christina Greer, is one of the Moynihan Public Scholars inaugural fellows. And Flaming Hydra, a collective of 60 writers, including me, delivering a cooperatively owned new newsletter you'll actually want to read. Our engineer is the inimitable Adam Kamara, and I'm our executive producer. A special thank you to Steve for coming on and joining us. The podcast is The Burden. Find it at the podcast places. And thank you, listener, for joining us and making it this far. Be kind, be cool, and Christina and Katie will be back Monday with more. Goodbye.
In fact, there were a number of times on the job where everybody said no and I said yes, and believe it or not, it came back around and I was right. Not blowing my own horn, it's just fact.
Yeah, it's true.
You know that sounds crazy.
It does.
You know, it sounds like magic.
You see, detectives have the biggest egos in the world. The biggest and I guess I was one of them.
Louis, it's just, you know, it's like you say something like that, you know, never wrong in reading somebody. Never wrong in arresting anybody. How can you never make a mistake? I mean, you're perfect?
No, I'm far from perfect. And I was far from, you know, Steve, let me say this to you. I know my cases. Put yourself here. After everything that was said about you in the last 10 years, put yourself here. I, in my mind, dissected every single case, homicide. I humbly say to you, if you could tell me that on this case, Louis, you're wrong. This person didn't do it. This person did it. And his confession to you was wrong. You have to prove that to me. Show me a case where there was DNA. Show me where there's someone else who did the crime. And I will be the first one to say, I did my job.